The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Okay, so now Hannah Gordon reads the first episode of a five-part abridgment of Martin Stannard's biography of Muriel Spark. Today we hear about Muriel's upbringing in Edinburgh.
Muriel Sarah Camberg arrived in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. on the 1st of February 1918 and immediately became her parents' princess. Later in life, she would occasionally amuse herself with the fantasy that she was a real princess, kidnapped by gypsies, her parents. She saw her life as a Cinderella story. How she emerged from that family intrigued her. She was born in a small rented flat at 160 Brunsfield Place in the Morningside district of Edinburgh. Her brother Philip had made his appearance 5.5 years earlier down the hill at 55 Viewforth. He welcomed his new sister guardedly. During April 1962, with the great success of the prime of Miss Jean Brodie behind her and life as a celebrity ahead, she began to reflect on all this. She was back in Edinburgh, attending her father's deathbed in the Royal Infirmary. What was she doing in the elegant North British Hotel when her mother, brother and son were gathered in the family home? By hitching her legs up onto the windowsill of her hotel room, she could prop herself on one side or the other. The broad sash was lifted, opening to the left on the craggy outcrop of Arthur's Seat, to the right on Princes Street Gardens. Above everything lowered the castle, erupting between the old town and the new. This brutal caesura, dividing the tangle of ancient closes from the rational elegance of 18th century town planning, seemed to her somehow symbolic. There was a link between the topography of Edinburgh and the topography of her mind. Most people in her circumstances that day would have been saturated in melancholy. But Muriel was not like most people. Her response to the world was rarely one of self-pity. She was an artist, a channel through which impressions could flow, a cold medium. At moments like this, when she could feel an image crystallizing, the thrill of creation isolated her from the injuries of the terrestrial world, and she would give herself up to the process, never knowing where it might lead. On this occasion, she felt an inpouring of love for her native city. Its style, its tricks of speech, its provincial puritanism and cosmopolitan hauteur. It was the city itself, rather than her family, that had nurtured her as an artist. It was Edinburgh, she wrote, that bred within me the condition of exiledom. And what have I been doing since but moving from exile into exile? Her father, Bernard or Barney Camberg, was a Jew. Her mother, Sarah, Sissy Camberg, née Uzel, had been brought up as a Christian, but probably to please him, had married him in a synagogue. It was a liberal-minded, happy-go-lucky family. And as she looked out over the city, she realised that this unexpected welling up of affection was psychologically connected with my love for my father and with the exiled sensation of occupying a hotel room meant for strangers. Now that he was dying, she would soon, metaphorically speaking, be homeless. The day of his death, 21st of April, 1962, was for Muriel something of an epiphany, and the metaphor centering on the castle began to take shape. To have a great primitive black crag rising up in the middle of populated streets of commerce, stately squares and winding closes, she wrote, is like the statement of an unmitigated fact preceded by nevertheless. The speech habit she now remembered, which had always fascinated her when listening to her teachers, or to the murmuring, tight-lipped women in musquash coats taking tea at McVitie's, was that word of final justification, nevertheless. My whole education, in and out of school, seemed even then to pivot around this word. I approve of the ceremonious accumulation of weather forecasts and barometer readings that pronounce for a fine day, before letting rip on the statement, nevertheless, it's raining. I find that much of my literary composition is based on the nevertheless idea. I act upon it. It was on the nevertheless principle that I turned Catholic. Although she could look out on the city with the nostalgia of one who was grateful to have known a place where she had once felt safe, she knew that the last shadow of its unqualified love had faded. From that point, she was on her own, and she began to make arrangements to live abroad. It was the hinge of her life, the point at which the second half of her existence began to rewrite the first. Bransfield Place today is much the same as it was during Muriel's childhood. Respectable grey stone tenements rise 3 floors above a string of small shops. Between these shops, the heavy staircase doors are tight shut against strangers. In 1918, visitors stood between Miss Morrison's confectionery and Lauder's shoes to pull a brass knob which rang the bell. It tinkled frequently in the Camberg's first floor flat, and Muriel listened for it eagerly. Sissy was 29 when Muriel was born, Barney 32. Bransfield Place was comfortably petit bourgeois. Few of its residents were working class, fewer still were Jewish. Both parents were anxious about financial security and keen to provide for their children's advancement. So Barney took skilled factory work at the North British Rubber Company and remained with the firm as a fitter and mechanical engineer until he retired at the age of 70. One senses that Barney was a frustrated man, resilient, droll, industrious, yet taciturn and lacking the real fierceness of ambition. When he mentioned the idea of opening a shop, Sissy would dissuade him, "Oh, think of the outlay, think of the risk." When living in their first flat in Viewforth, she had suffered a breakdown after disturbing an intruder, and she never allowed anyone to forget it. From that point, she drank every day to steady herself. She was never drunk, but she liked being queenly. Despite Barney's low wages, the Cambergs insisted on sending their children to a fee-paying school. Gillespie's was not one of Edinburgh's glamorous schools. In the 1930s, it was the equivalent of a small local grammar school. The imposing building presented a granite face to the world, but harboured its charges tenderly. The timeless vitality of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie derives at least partly from its affectionate portrait of Gillespie's as the Marcia Blaine School. Miss Brodie herself bears a strong resemblance to the woman in whose class Muriel sat, awestruck as a dumpy 11 and 12-year-old, Christina Kay. "That character in search of an author," she wrote, whose classroom walls were adorned with reproductions of early and Renaissance paintings, entered my imagination immediately. I started to write about her even then. Brodie's famous remark that her girls were the crème de la crème was also Miss Kay's. She realised, Muriel noted, that our parents' interest in our welfare was only marginally cultural. When Miss Kay veered off in the middle of a sentence to discuss Corot's Touch of Red or the Latin root of to educate, Muriel discovered in herself the artist and the intellectual craving sustenance which could not be provided at home. It was more the style than the content of this teaching which excited and empowered Muriel. Miss Kay's mental habit of proceeding by dazzling non sequiturs rather than by logical progression. Despite Miss Kay's naive interest in Mussolini, she was profoundly anti-nationalist. They were taught by the school's ethos, not just by Miss Kay, to listen to what was so easy to sing, not to be carried away by crowd emotions, not to be fools. This was a priceless gift, part of which, for Muriel at least, was a nascent scepticism about all systems of power and their potential for corrupting free will. Miss Kay taught her to reject the politics of victimhood. For all this, however, perhaps because of this, her teacher spirit is reincarnated in Jean Brodie as ambiguously beneficial. The loyalty she demands of her pupils becomes an imposition. She is, in fact, another version of that recurrently sinister figure in Muriel's fiction, the incubus. Brodie is not Kay, but Kay transfigured. The huge influence of Miss Kay had little to do with physical beauty or iconoclasm. She was a devout Christian. Under her wing, Muriel flourished in scripture studies. Yet her teacher lingered in Muriel's memory as a figure of fantasy who strangely concentrated the political and sexual forces surging round her in the Edinburgh of 1929 to 1930. She was to write, "Did Miss Kay have a sweetheart in her life? I think she did, long before our time. She was of the generation of clever, academically trained women who had lost their sweethearts in the 1914-18 war. There had been a terrible carnage. There were no men to go round. Until we ourselves grew up, there was a veritable generation of spinsters. At any rate, Miss Kay told us how wonderful it had been to waltz in those long full skirts. I sensed romance, sex." Muriel's fame at Gillespie's rested on her poetry. In 1931, a selection of poems from Edinburgh School magazines was issued as a book, The Door of Youth, in which Muriel's work figured prominently. The last of her poems for Gillespie's magazine, called Dust, echoes Yeats, the scholars. Vivid life is opposed to dreary study. Poppies laugh while they are young, wild and bright and burning. You were dusty all your days with your books and learning. Poppies grin upon your grave, your dusty soul is gone. Crumbles the rest to dust and dust under that cold stone. At 16, Muriel was very much wild and bright and burning. To continue to study for university was not an option. By the time she matriculated, she was in no doubt that she was an artist and that, in order to write about life as I intended to do, I had first to live. The essentials of literature were, to me, outside of literature. They were elsewhere, out in the world. The dutiful earnestness of the female students at Edinburgh University did not appeal. That was death. Art was life.
So, marriage to an older man offers escape from the claustrophobia of Edinburgh's social microcosm. But the excesses of life in colonial Africa soon prove overwhelming when Hannah Gordon reads the next part of Muriel Spark, The Biography by Martin Stannard. The producer